Merry Christmas. You might be wondering why I'm back with yet another video after having promised you that I have done my last video and I'm going on holiday. I am wondering that as well. I am pretty exhausted and really should be on holiday now, but I have come back for one final video, because only a few days left of the year, because I want to ask something from you. Don't worry, it's not money. I would like you, if possible, to help me with the project that I have been working very hard on the last couple of months. So for those of you who haven't heard, I have been working on a documentary about the economy for Channel 4. I've been running up and down the country, speaking to lots and lots of different people to try and tell a story about the country and about the economy. And I would like, if possible, to allow some of you to tell your stories as well. So I am going to ask you to tell your stories of the economy and send them in to us so that, if possible, we can maybe use them in a documentary. And I'm going to put a video out tomorrow with all the details of that. But I didn't feel like I could come back at this time of year and ask you to give me a gift without doing, at the very least, something for you. So I have prepared a little Christmas message based on the work of one of my favourite authors, Charles Dickens. His work, The Christmas Carol, in which he talks about the past, the present and the future. So here's my Christmas message for 2025. Okay, so I've got a little stack of books here behind my laptop because I want to talk through some of my favourite books, including a couple by Charles Dickens. So I haven't spoken about this much on the channel, but I love books, especially novels and classic fiction. I'm a massive fan of Charles Dickens. I'm normally reading about 10, 15 books at a time. And one of the books that I'm reading at the moment is David Copperfield by Charles Dickens, which I'm nearly finished. It's about 1,000 pages, this book. I think I've got 100 to go. Oh, that's in the way of my mince pies. This is Charles Dickens's semi-autobiographical work. I think the reason it's called David Copperfield is the initials are DC, which is like a flip of CD, which is Charles Dickens's initials. He was named after the things you used to put in computers. And in this book, he talks about, you know, growing up in quite a difficult home as a kid and having books as a kind of an escape and something which he used to sort of, yeah, help deal with difficult times when he was a kid. And that was quite funny for me because when I was a kid, sometimes the house I grew up in was quite difficult and I read avidly all of the books in my house, including Oliver Twist and Great Expectations by Charles Dickens. And I read those when I was like a really young kid and I didn't understand them at all, basically. But it was kind of emotional to me to see that Charles Dickens himself was using sort of books as an escape when he was a kid. And then when I was a kid, Charles Dickens's books were kind of an escape for me. So for anyone who doesn't know who Charles Dickens is, he is, I think, arguably the most famous English British novelist of all time. He was writing in the 19th century, the 1800s, during the Victorian period. And I want to start my discussion of past. We're starting with Christmas past. What can we learn from the past? With what can we learn from Charles Dickens himself? So I sometimes talk about sort of the history of economics. When we read Charles Dickens, what we're reading is a picture of what the history was like in this country, in England, at a period when England, Britain, was the richest and most powerful country in the world. And a lot of what Charles Dickens writes about is poverty and inequality. And anybody who's, you know, seen or read Oliver Twist or really any of Charles Dickens' books will see what he writes about a lot is just explaining how much poverty there was in that time. And I think what is interesting to recognise about that is you're seeing like tremendous poverty. You know, this is a time when, you know, Charles Dickens himself was sent to, I think, polish shoes in a workhouse when he was just a kid, when a lot of young children are forced to work, doing things like going up chimneys, when there was incredible poverty. And that was at the height of the Industrial Revolution in the richest country in the world. So what does that teach us about the economy? What that teaches us is, first, poverty is not just something that happens in poor countries. So I often think back to the term that Donald Trump used a year or two ago when he talked about shithole countries. And the reason I think about that a lot is I think when he said that, what you see there is a quite naive assumption that poverty is something that happens in poor countries. And I think sometimes there's a little bit of naive racism underneath that, which is like in places like Europe, in places like the UK, we can never be poor. We can never have the kind of poverty that you see in much of Africa or in much of Asia or in lots of Latin America. What Charles Dickens teaches us is that poverty can happen here. That poverty did happen here. It can happen in the richest countries in the world. Life can be really, really bad for ordinary people, even in phenomenally rich countries, if you do not deal with inequality. Inequality is another one of the big things of his book. So I think the first thing we can learn from Charles Dickens is to be careful. Charles Dickens teaches us poverty can happen in rich countries like Britain, like the US. It did happen in Britain when Britain was the richest country in the world. Yeah, and the other thing that it shows us is that technology does not necessarily fix the problem. Dickens was writing in the height of the Industrial Revolution, which has got to be, I think, the biggest and fastest ever increase in economical technology in the history of the world. And he was writing from Britain, which was the center of the Industrial Revolution. And here you have this unbelievably massive increase in economic productivity, which should have lifted everybody out of poverty and could have lifted everybody out of poverty. But what it actually led to was for many people, even in Britain, in the center of the Industrial Revolution, in the richest country in the world, it led in many cases to desperate poverty. So I think now, as we have this sort of explosion in technology, computers, the internet, and obviously what we're seeing now is AI, often you see from the sort of tech bros, the idea that technology will save us. What Dickens teaches us and what the past teaches us is that poverty can and will happen in rich countries if you don't take care of inequality, and technology will not necessarily save us if we do not deal with inequality. I want to introduce another book by Charles Dickens, because while I was writing my book, The Trading Game, available in all good stores, I was reading lots of books, including this one here, which is Hard Times by Charles Dickens, another great book by Charles Dickens. He's written a lot of great books. And this book has in it an industrialist, what's he called? Bounderby or something. There's a great scene in this book, which I was reading while I wrote my book just a couple of years ago, where this industrialist is complaining that the government is trying to raise taxes on industrialists like him. And he says that if we raise taxes on the rich, on the industrialists, he and all of the industrialists, the factory owners like him, will pick up their factories and throw them into the sea. And I think this was a sort of wonderful, very like Dickensian flourish, kind of to highlight the absurdity of the fact that these guys who own everything are not going to throw their stuff into the sea. But obviously reading that just a couple of years ago when I was writing my book, the thing that really stands out there is that this debate which we're having now, can you tax rich people, should you tax rich people, goes back a long time. And rich people have always argued that we shouldn't tax them. And they will always argue that we shouldn't tax them. And this is a fight which we will always have to fight. The question, of course, is should we tax them or shouldn't we? And I think that question can also be answered by history. Because when we read Dickens, we should see it as a warning that rich countries and technologically advanced countries can have really bad broad living standards if you don't deal with inequality. But you should also read it, I think, as a sign of hope. Because what Dickens shows us is that in the relatively recent history, you know, Dickens was writing 150 years ago, but that poverty still existed in this country even 100 years ago. We had desperate poverty in this country, the richest country in the world. I speak often about how my grandma lost three of her siblings to tuberculosis, which was a disease of poverty. That was in the 1920s or the 1930s. But history also teaches us that in this country and in most Western countries, we went in a relatively short time from this kind of broad Dickensian poverty in rich technologically advanced countries to very, very quickly the kind of country that my dad lived in, where an ordinary person without any advanced degrees, with an ordinary job, could afford to buy houses, have healthcare, have education, all for free, have good quality food and have a pension. And that change happened in just 50 years. So I think what Dickens teaches us and what the past teaches us is, number one, a warning of how bad things can become, even in rich, technologically advanced countries like probably yours. I know most of our viewers are in the UK or the US or Europe or Australia. It is a warning of how bad things can get, but the past is also a real phenomenal source of hope for me, because it shows us that in just 50 years, from the early 20th century to the late 20th century, we moved from this Dickensian country of phenomenal poverty to the kind of country that my dad and maybe your dad grew up in, where people working regular jobs could live in financial security and dignity. And how did that happen? Well, that is another lesson that we can learn from the past. That happened because of the amazing, ambitious things that were achieved immediately after the Second World War, which was a period where, just like now, governments across the West, including the British government, had phenomenally high government debts. The government debt was, I think, more than twice what it is now, as a percent of GDP after the Second World War. And despite those enormous debts, people came back from the war. And of course, women also moved on from what they had experienced in the war. And they said, we are going to demand healthcare, housing, education, food, and financial security. And they got that. They achieved those things. I think one of the things that is most amazing to me about how they did that is, when I do the work that I do today, and we'll move on to Christmas present very soon, I often get the argument back that it's impossible. It's impossible to tax rich people. It's impossible to reduce inequality. It's impossible to give people broad living standards. And that argument is made with this lesson of history, which is, we did it. We did it once before. In the middle of the 20th century, we moved from a country with really terrible, broad, desperate poverty to one which provided a good, decent standard of living to the vast majority of people. And they achieved that in the context of the immediate aftermath of this terrible war. Most of the countries in Europe bombed and destroyed, government debts enormously high, and no historical example of that ever being achieved. I think it's unbelievably inspirational what the people of this country and this continent did after the Second World War, because they had never seen it done before, and they did it. And they did it by taxing rich people. So when anybody ever says to you, it's impossible to reduce inequality, it's impossible to give broad living standards to ordinary people, it's impossible to make things better, it's impossible to tax rich people, just like the arguments were being made by the industrialist in Dickens's time, turn around to them and say, your granddad did it. Your granddad did it 70 years ago in the aftermath of probably the most terrible thing that humanity has ever done, the Second World War. They came back from that and they said, we want things to be better. And they achieved it with no historical precedent by taxing rich people. So yeah, your grandparents did it. History shows us things can get worse, but things can get better. And with that, I'll move on to Christmas present. Okay, Christmas present. There's less Dickens in this bit. Where are we now? To be honest, it's difficult for me to think about the present without sort of thinking about just how exhausted I am, basically. I've really worked hard this year and I'm tired. And it's been difficult. I've become quite famous this year and I've had to figure out how to deal with that. There's been a sort of shift, especially in the last sort of few months, away from sort of arguing against my ideas and towards sort of just calling me an idiot, which is sometimes unpleasant. But to be honest, I think it's a victory in the sense that they've given up arguing my ideas and have just started pointing fingers. I think that's a good sign for where we're going. But it being Christmas, I think it would be very unwise and unkind perhaps of me to think about the difficulties of my own Christmas this year, my own year, without recognising that there will be a lot of people this year whose Christmas will be much, much more difficult than mine. I grew up in quite a poor family, and Christmas was one of the few times that I got anything really. I was telling my production team, I used to make my Christmas chocolate last till Easter, my Easter chocolate last till Christmas. So I know what it's like to struggle at Christmas. But the truth is, there'll be a lot of people, a lot of parents who don't know how they're going to put presents under the tree. I know this is coming out just after Christmas. And I've been travelling around the last few weeks and I've spoken to a lot of people. And one thing that always stands out to me when I do that is how The vast majority of people in this country, and probably your country too, if you're watching from America or Europe or Australia, are worried about the direction of the economy. But the specific form of that worry really varies from person to person. You know, I get a lot of messages on the channel asking me for investment advice and asking me if I think there's going to be a market collapse. And of course, if you're asking that question, you probably have a decent amount of money to invest. And that doesn't mean you shouldn't be worried about market collapse. But obviously, there are a lot of people that don't have any money to be able to deal with these problems. And then there's a lot of people whose main concern is, will I ever be able to buy a house? Which is incredibly serious, of course. But there are also a lot of people for whom the idea of ever even buying a house is a desperate pipe dream because they can't even pay the rent. And there will be a lot of people who this year have had to skip meals in order to put presents under the tree for their kids. And what I feel when I see that is basically is worry, because if different people are in very different financial positions and they're all worried about the economy, it creates this opportunity, especially for press owned by very wealthy people, to get them all pointing the finger at each other. And you see this a lot in the press, ideas where sort of the middle class, who are a little bit more financially secure but are worried because they are getting poorer, are told the reason you're getting poorer is because of people on benefits or because of asylum seekers. You know, there's really potential for division between people who own property and people who don't own property in this country. And I think if we become a country where we all advocate aggressively for our own economic group and we don't protect other economic groups, then we really create this potential, which I think is what has been happening for the last 20, 25 years, really, where society just sort of gets cut off of economic protection and dignity, kind of from the bottom up. A story I sometimes tell is a story of Oasis, a very popular British pop band, punk, indie, what are we calling them?
Yeah, indie rock.
Indie rock, Jack says, a very popular indie rock band when I was growing up, about how they were on the dole for a long time. They were on benefits for a long time. And they were able to live on benefits. I'm sure they were not rich. I know they come from poor backgrounds. And they were able to use that time to sort of get their music experience and build things up. And the Beatles had a very similar experience, working in poverty for a long period of time. And what you see there, I guess another lesson from the past, is we were for a long time a country where young people could afford, because they were supported by the country they live in, to take a little bit of time to figure out what they're doing and what they want to do. But we've cut that off now, basically. And what you see there is basically we're sort of cutting people off from economic security from the bottom up. You know, during the austerity period, it hit mainly the poor. And then you're starting to see this percentage of people being dragged into poverty going up and up and up. And now you're seeing with the current government sort of going after the middle class, more and more and more people being dragged in. And when I look at the present, what I see is a country that is being phenomenally weakened by division, essentially. It reminds me of, this is a very famous poem, which I was supposed to bring up before I started this video, but I'm bringing it up now. And you probably will all know this. There's a very famous poem by a German pastor, I think, in the aftermath of the Second World War and the Holocaust, which I'll repeat for those who don't know, but probably most of you will know, which is, this is a slightly shortened version. First they came for the socialists and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unions. Then they came for the trade unionists and I did not speak out. People always wonder if these are real. They are. Then they came for the trade unionists and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me and there was no one left to speak for me. Now this is a very well-known poem. And it's obviously in the context of World War II. But if you can't see the relevance to modern day Britain, I think you don't have your eyes open, to be honest. If you keep allowing the economic structure of your society to eat the people at the bottom of the society, eventually you will be the person being eaten. And who is going to protect you? And what I mean when I say that is, the reason you should care about other people in your society who might be poorer than you who might not be in the same economic situation as you. And the reason you should try to empathize for them is not just to be a good person, and it's not just to take care of others. It is also about you. It is about protecting a society that protects you. Because if you accept living in this kind of Squid Game society, where every few years we kill the bottom 10%, eventually you will be the bottom 10%. And who is going to be there to protect you politically? This is what I mean when I say it's incredibly important, both in this country and your country, wherever you are watching, that the middle class is able to ally with and protect the working class. Because if you don't protect them, then who's going to protect you when the rich come for you and for the houses that your kids need? But the other thing that I think when I think about the present and the experience I've had in the last few months going around the country, speaking to a lot of people, is that there is an enormous demand for change in this country. And I've been all around the world this year, talking in a lot of countries, and I know there's enormous demand for change everywhere. There's a desperation for something more. There's a desperation for something different. I think that's why you're seeing the collapse of traditional political parties all across the West, including in this country. And the other thing that I've seen is that people want to fight for something. You know, I've spoken to a lot of different people who are trying to deal with this economic collapse in living standards in a lot of different ways. And what I've found is a lot of people are trying to deal with it in a way which you might describe as selfish. And there's no judgment on those people, because I know that when economic security is hard to get, you're going to prioritise taking care of yourself. But I've also spoken to a lot of people who, alongside doing that, are also trying to stand together to protect each other and to build a better society. And what I've found, I've asked a lot of people, do you feel optimistic for the future? And pretty much every time, the people who are fighting just for themselves are terribly pessimistic about the future. But the people who are fighting for each other, with each other, believe that things can get better and will get better. And that brings me on to the final section, which is the future. So the future is a funny thing for me, because my profession really was, and in many ways still is, predicting the future from an economic perspective, obviously. And I've got a very, very good track record of that. And for a long time now, ever since 2011, really, so coming up to 15 years, I've been kind of convinced in my predictions of the future that living standards and politics will get worse. And unfortunately, throughout the course of those 14, 15 years, I've watched those predictions pretty much always be right. And I think this, for me, raises a question of how do we live with that knowledge? It's been a difficult thing which I've had to figure out. I keep having to try not to bring it up at dinner parties. But I think it's becoming more and more obvious to more and more people that economics and living standards and politics are getting worse. And at least in the short term, that will continue. I'm very, very confident of that. Which raises the question of how do we as individuals cope with that? I think it's a difficult thing to accept, especially in a world where, for many of us, we feel primarily defined by our ability to make money. We expect life to get better generation after generation. We expect and hope that as we get older, we will get richer and more financially secure. Until we get political change, and I do believe we will get it, but I don't think it will happen soon, these things which we have become used to and which we use to define ourselves will be out of reach for the majority of people. So how do we stay calm in a world where we're told, if you're not getting richer, you're a failure? And yet there are increasingly really diminishing possibilities of actually getting richer. And for that, I'm going to bring in another book, which is one of my favourite books, one of my favourite authors, which I wanted to have on the table, but I must have given my copy away. I was looking around before I shot this. So just imagine I'm holding it here. One of my favourite books, which I quoted in my book, which is Slaughterhouse-Five by the American author Kurt Vonnegut, where he talks about the importance of stories of the dignity of poverty. And he speaks about how for the vast majority of European history, the vast majority of people were poor. We lived in Europe in very unequal societies. Wealth was largely inherited. It wasn't to do with how hard you work or how smart you were. It was just about who your dad was, And that was the world that we lived in. And in that world, it was much more obvious that personal virtue and personal dignity were not connected to how rich you are. Because everybody could see that how rich you are was basically due to how rich your dad was. And we had a lot of folk tales in European history, the most famous, of course, in this country being that Robin Hood, of the dignity of poor people and the importance of fighting for poor people and fighting for ordinary people. Of course, we have these in, even in the Bible, these ideas that it is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to get into heaven. And Kurt Vonnegut talks about how, this is Kurt Vonnegut's words, not mine, I'm paraphrasing, how in America, this new country, it hadn't, because it was a young country, it hadn't yet been able to develop these folk tales, these myths of poor people living good, virtuous, dignified, noble lives. And it had led to this kind of perception in the mind of people that the only way to be virtuous, the only way to be noble and dignified is to be rich. And he thinks, I think he's trying to imply in his book, that led to a kind of a moral emptiness and a sadness, I think, in the people. We did live for a good 40 or 50 years in countries where you could get rich if you worked hard. We don't live in those countries anymore. And I think it's phenomenally important that we create stories for young people, especially for young men, that make it clear that you can be noble and you can be dignified and you can be good without being rich. Because the truth is, it will be almost impossible for the vast majority of people born today, born tomorrow, or even born 10, 15 years ago to ever get rich if they don't come from the right family. The question then is, what are the stories that we create for young people today? What can young people strive to? What can young people strive to become? And I think, you don't have to agree with me, the lesson I've learned from going around the country and speaking to lots of people, you don't stop working. You don't stop trying to make money, because you have to do that if you want a family, and you've got every right to want a family and a home. Those are not things you should be embarrassed for wanting. But from the people I've spoken to in the last few months, the people who seem to have meaning and seem to have hope, seem to believe in something for the future, are the people who, alongside the work that they do and alongside the money that they make, also try to stand together to fight for something bigger. And I think those are the stories which we need to create. And those are the stories which I think in his own way, Dickens was trying to tell. And I think those are the stories which I'm going to try my best to tell here. And I know some of you, when you hear that, you might find that a little overwhelming, especially those of you who are struggling with some of the more basics of life. And I understand that. When I was young, I was poor, and the truth is I didn't care that much for other people. When you're poor and no one's helping you, it's very natural, I think, to try your best to help yourself. And in response to that, I'm going to refer once more to the Bible. I'm not religious, by the way, but I just like to get more Bible verses into my stories. And the Bible story of the widow's mite, which is in both Mark and Luke. My mum's going to be really happy that I'm getting these Bible stories in. It's a very short story. It's included a couple of times in the Bible of Jesus and his apostles in a temple and seeing all of these people donate money. And there are a lot of wealthy people donating a lot of money, perhaps in some ostentatious ways. A very poor widow came up and she threw in two mites, which is an old currency, I assume. Obviously, in modern English, it's come to mean a very, very small thing. And she donated an extremely small amount to the church. And Jesus brought his disciples together and he said to them, this poor widow has cast more in than anybody else, because everybody else cast in from their abundance, but she cast in all that she had. And I would never ask anybody to give all that you have. I know it's a difficult world, but the truth is, you know, life is not a Marvel movie. This isn't a situation of the heroes come in and save the world. The truth is, unfortunately, the vast majority of the richest and most powerful people in the world are actively working towards making it worse for whatever reason. If this is won, this will be won by a multitude of poor people casting in their one or two pennies. And I'm not asking for money here. What I'm asking you to do is contribute something. Doesn't have to be money. Understand what's happening. Share it with your friends. Share it with your family. Support good people who are doing good work. Doesn't have to be me. Lots of other people. It doesn't even have to be this cause. But in my opinion, if you want to find meaning and dignity in a world which does not offer wealth to many, it is going to be important that you work towards something bigger than yourself. So that's it, basically. This was my Christmas message. We're going to come out with the shout out tomorrow, asking for people to tell us their stories on the economy. This video should come out 28th, and I think we're going to put that one out 29th, Monday evening, the shout out. But that's it. What can I say? It's been a crazy year. I'm pretty tired and I've worked pretty hard, but I'm proud of what I've achieved, what we've achieved together here. I'm going to go take a rest, but you guys have a good new year and the rest of the Christmas period. Be there for each other because you're going to need each other. Good luck.